Let's say we will move on from the regulations committee. Dan?
How can we get a signed exchange document? Everybody's full on.
Because I love you.
We want to start.
Oh, it's cool. I'll take two minutes there. Anyway, so the ball was for me. The last one's family.
Regulations committee's first order of business is the approval of the previous committee meeting minutes, which have already been distributed. Is there a motion for approval? Moved by Brown and seconded by Commissioner Bivens. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, motion carries. Committee item number one, land and water plan update, Mr. Cook.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. TBWD closes another license buyback application period for the commercial bay and bait shrimp boat licenses May 4th, 2007. In the 20th round for the shrimp buyback, we have received 140 applications, of which 49 appear to be acceptable. That's 21 bay and 28 bait licenses. If all acceptable applications result in contracts, this round will cost us $375,700. Currently, there are 635 commercial bay and 623 commercial bait shrimp boat licenses remaining in the fisheries. The first Texas spring alligator season began on April 1, 2007. So far, TPWD has issued alligator CITES tags, wild harvest hide tags, to 45 hunters for alligators taken in the first half of the new season. The new alligator season is open statewide through the months through April, May, and June in all but the 22 core counties. Most of the gators that have been harvested have come from the coastal and South Texas counties, with Cameron County, Brownsville, currently leading with 7 gators harvested in Cameron County. The second year of the Mule Deer MLD program has been successfully completed. We now have 65 ranches encompassing just under 3 billion acres enrolled in that program.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman. Thank you. Can you repeat the number on the buyback? I missed that.
We have 49 licenses that appear to be acceptable. They will cost us $375,700.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Committee item number two, commercial collection and sale of non-game wildlife. That way.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Commission. My name is Matt Wagner. I'm the Program Director for Wildlife Diversity. Today we're coming to you with some proposed changes to our non-game permit program. Just to give you some background, we know there's a growing demand for non-game for the pet trade and food. This is combined with an unrestricted commercial harvest in Texas. Regulations in other states tend to be a little tighter than Texas. The increased pressure in Texas from other out-of-state collectors and dealers has furthered the growing demand, primarily for turtle meat. We know that turtles in particular are vulnerable to over-collecting. There have been a number of studies that are done looking at turtles both from a species approach and more of a general approach in terms of the decline in some countries. Box turtles, red-eared sliders, soft shells, and common snapping turtles are turtles that are commercially important in Texas. When you look at the other work that has been done, the published literature will point to the fact that unrestricted commercial use does lead to decline in turtles and other long-lived species. Some of the authors are actually in the room with us today. They may choose to speak tomorrow. Just wanted you to see the titles of some of these papers that look at the commercialization of turtles in Texas and in other countries, as well as in the United States. Now, the current proposal in the Texas Register would create a whitelist of 84 non-game species legal for commercial use. For species not on the whitelist, a possession limit of 6 per species is proposed. But commercial use of species not on the list would be prohibited. Now, currently, no turtles are on the proposed whitelist. Our intent is to allow continued legal control of turtles in private waters, which is legal today. As far as the public comment, we've had nearly 1,500 comments on this item. A lot of interest out there. 91% in favor of the proposal as published, about 1,300 comments, including, I think, 90 comments from elementary school kids out of Memorial in Houston. 140 or so that were opposed to the proposal. The main objections that we've seen are the fact that this rule would prohibit commercial collection of turtles on private property. In addition, it would not allow the importation of indigenous non-game from other states, and then the grandfathering of those that are currently in possession of non-game, either for their own use or for commercial breeding operations. Other imposing views included 26 comments that turtles were a nuisance, 11 comments that we had no scientific justification for these rules, and then 7 comments questioning the whitelist approach. And as you can imagine, a lot of the comments had a lot of overlap, but those were the main categories that broke down the opposition. Now, recommended changes from staff would be to allow for importation of non-game species into Texas for sale and subsequent exportation with documentation of origin. Secondly, we'd like to grandfather existing private collection and develop a procedure over the next 12 months for handling captive breeding operations. This would most likely involve a new permit for captive breeding operations. Because non-game covers such a wide array of wildlife, we want to exempt certain species from this rule. And that would include coyotes, bobcats, and mountain lions, rabbits, which are hunted as non-game, but there is no limit, and then American bison. We found out that bison are actually classified as non-game in Texas, and there are people engaged in commercial activities for bison. To address the private property concerns, a regulatory alternative is provided for your consideration. And this would be to allow commercial use from private property for 3 groups of turtles, the red-eared slider, the soft-shell turtles, of which there are 5 subspecies, the common snapping turtle. Annual reporting would still be required as currently from our non-game dealers. That is what I have for you, and if there's any discussion, we'd be happy to answer your questions.
Matt, I've learned over the past 6 years it's taken a lot of learning this, but one of the first questions on any of the regulations is the enforcement issue. Fish traps in public waters are illegal. Today, turtle traps aren't. If we go with this proposal, all traps in public waters will be illegal, right?
I may ask David Sinclair to approach and answer that question.
I don't know if Forrest can fill in. Oh, come on, David. I didn't see you back there. I had a uniform.
Undercover.
Yeah. Undercover. Undercover turtle operator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Major David Sinclair, Chief of Wildlife Enforcement. And Mr. Chairman, in regard to your question, fishing devices are prohibited in public water, including those that are capable of catching fish, you know, for commercial sale. Right now, a person can use a minnow seine or a minnow trap to catch bait, and then we also have the regulation about turtle traps, and there's a little bit of a conflict there, so it would prohibit the use of the turtle trap.
Simple question, makes your job easier to do this.
Much easier.
Makes enforcement easier in public waters.
Okay.
You'd be taking away turtle traps from public waters.
If I'll say it a different way, turtle traps are sort of an exception to the fish trap prohibition now, and we would eliminate that with this proposal. Okay, now, how do you tell a turtle, how do you tell the difference between a turtle captured in private water and captured in public water?
Well, they look very much alike. So, you know, it's on the amount of documentation. Someone in possession is going to have documentation where they acquired the turtle.
Okay. I don't mean to be light on this. This is a serious subject.
Yeah, yeah.
There's a choke point, right, in the commercial trade here. At the, I'm going to guess they're going to China. The choke point is going to be DFW, Houston, or Continental. Anywhere else? Pretty much
it. Probably going to be it for export.
80-90% of it? Okay. So our warden inspects a shipment. What's that person going to have to prove that it didn't come from public water?
Well, there will be those transshipments that are just coming through. And you know, there should be documentation from the country or state of origin. And those may be just passing on through. If there's anything, you know, being exported out of the state, there should be documentation from the non-game dealer. Should be some document attached to that invoice or an affidavit showing where it came from.
Okay, you said some document. I want to get into some detail on this. This is important.
Okay.
Is it to the point where the warden can look at that document, or maybe we need to propose this as part of the regulation, can look at that document and pick up his cell phone and call that person and say, did you sell 275 turtles to XY's?
Correct, and we've looked a little bit at the in the commercial fishing, the trip tickets that we started here recently, and we're talking about something similar to that, which would show the buyer and the seller enough information about the seller, we'd be able to contact him to confirm whether or not the sale was made.
Okay, do you feel comfortable with this?
Yes.
That you can enforce it?
Yes, sir, I think so.
And gather the data so that we can... So that Matt can come back and say, because right now we don't have real good numbers, right? It's pretty wide open.
We do have annual reports from the dealers, and we believe that information is obviously on the honor system. It's probably underreported, but another dimension to this would probably be a little bit more site-specific information of the origination of the turtle. Right now it's at the county level.
What I'm driving at is I want as good a data as we can get so that we understand whether or not we're protecting the resources.
Yes, let me. Go ahead. Let me be more simplistic. If I want to sell a turtle, what do I have to do?
Right now, you would need to either have a non-game permit,
okay,
or if you were a dealer, a non-game dealer permit.
Who do you have? And if you have a non-game dealer permit, what do I have to do with regards to the state? In other words, do they weekly, monthly, quarterly give us a report?
I sold
84 turtles.
No reporting by the collector, and that's the non-game permit. And you have the non-game dealer permit, and they're required to record the person that they buy from. And I send in that report.
I guess what I'm concerned, the person that is eventually selling and buying the turtles for consumption, do they both have to report to us?
The non-game permittees sell only to dealers legally. And so the dealers capture the information from the non-game permittees.
And all I'm trying to determine is the system such that we can, like Joe was saying, identify the source, site-specific, and then where it went, and then from that point where it eventually was shipped?
That's what we are going to design. We believe we can do that. Right now, we get the information at the county level.
With an affidavit from the center, I got 84 turtles from
right.
X County.
Currently, on a wildlife resource document, we capture that, doesn't delete that information. We know where it came from.
Only by county, only from the
client.
But the wildlife resource document is not used.
Do you plan to do?
We have one.
I think we're looking at more detailed information. And I guess when we first started this program, the collector was responsible for reporting as well. But I think there was some concern about total figures being skewed a little bit.
Is the reporting weekly, monthly, quarterly, annually?
Annually.
Okay, so that, and the only reason I say that is, If it's monthly or if it's in a shorter period of time, it gives you more of an opportunity to verify the accuracy of that than on an annual basis, where you've got to go back 10.5 months and say that these, or you get a lump sum, 2,400 turtles. See what I'm saying? That it makes your job, I think, a lot harder if you don't have a monthly reporting or and the site specific. Otherwise, they can just say, here's 2,400 turtles that I've bought here in the last year.
With the trip tickets that I mentioned earlier, we're talking about having them submit those within 48 hours.
Okay.
They have a batch, go to a dealer and then they'll be exported. They'll be reported to us, we can verify pretty quickly.
So that we would keep an accounting, I guess, on a weekly basis or whatever, or a daily basis, and then at the end, those tickets should tie into the final inventory.
Correct.
You have the resources to do it.
Yeah. That's what I was going to
do. I wanted to ask Mike.
I wanted to ask a question along those same lines. Is there going to be any sort of charge for this record keeping by the commercial dealers?
There currently is a fee for the non-game dealer permit, I believe.
No, I'm not talking about permit. I'm talking about this ever. The thing about
what reporting?
Yes, every shipment. I'm not talking about a one-year permit deal of a few bucks. I'm talking about every time we have to send a guy out to the airport or to wherever, that there is going to be a charge for that service that we are performing.
It would be something that we would definitely need to consider.
Well, I think what we're boiling down to here, if I may, is making sure that this isn't costing us money to obviously, the easier thing to do is ban it all. But personally, I think when you do that, you're ignoring the fact that people can kill all the turtles. If the resource anyway, without being a commercial practice. So if your real concern here is for the resource, then you ban the public first. Waterways first, because that's obviously no connection between the use and the stewardship. The people who are taking that resource have no control over the health of the resource. But we've got to get some real data here, and it's going to cost money to get it, and I want to make sure that the people who are benefiting commercially are paying the full freight for that oversight.
We have talked to the dealers about this. I think many of them understand the cost of tracking this, and would probably be willing to pay, obviously, to manage the resource.
I think that it's our responsibility to decide what it's going to cost us, and not allow some dealer out there to decide what it's going to cost him.
Understood.
Right.
A more fundamental issue is, can we quantify the impact that this industry has had on the resource? In other words, can we say we have lost 40% of the turtles, 20%, 10%? Because if it's a substantial impact, then we ought to be more aggressive. But if it's a concern into the future, then perhaps our regulation should be not quite as strict. So from a staff standpoint, I mean, how do you have to quantify the impact, the current impact of the shipping of these turtles, which you say is mild, medium, hard, you know, 10%. I'm trying to get a picture in my mind as to how significant or how aggressive a regulation should be.
I would characterize it like this. We have a huge and growing demand for turtle meat. We have unrestricted commercialization today. We need to move towards sustainability. Is this activity sustainable over the long term? We don't have the population data to couple with the tape. So we want to approach this from a science standpoint, and unfortunately, all we know is the science has been done elsewhere. But that work applies to Texas as well. We know that unrestricted tape over the long run leads to decline. That's a fact. So we want to get in front. I think it's safe to say that the three most commercially important turtles aren't ready to be put on a threatened list, but we want to get there. We want to get in front of it now, and we want to take the information that we can get and come back to you with more specific information. If we need to further restrict based on the biology of these animals and what is commercially sustainable, we can do that. We can propose further rules for you.
Yeah, and the aggressiveness of the regulation will be driven by what we learn as we go through. Okay, that's fair.
I think that is it safe to say, I mean, what we're dealing with now, to address Mr. Parker's question, what we have now is a system that's pretty wide open. We don't have whatever our rates that we're currently charging for the permit. We're going to look at that with this group. We're going to look at what it's going to take for us to come back, analyze, come back year after year with recommendations regarding the regulations, whether that's more or less of this. But that's something that we need to work with this group on, work with the science folks on, and we'll find that number that hopefully provides funding to cover our cost. What we've got now is a cost and resource, and we need to be able to get a better handle on that. This is an interesting process that we're in here with this one, one that we've been working on for about 15 years, really. And this is a big step. As you recall, staff's original presentation was, proposal was, and original recommendations were, cut it off. Based on the input that we got through this process and working with folks that are involved, private landowners are involved, we felt like what staff has come forward with as an option here is a reasonable recommendation, a reasonable step. It allows us to gather information. We need to develop our system, our reporting system, better, and possibly, as Commissioner Thomas says, require a more frequent reporting process that really helps in enforcement. When we get a truckload of turtles out there on the highway, we're going to be able to trace that truckload of turtles back to that landowner.
Yeah. We've got our lawyer here, so I want to ask you this question. Is there a presumption if they can't prove that it's legally harvested on private waters, will there be a presumption?
I don't think that there's a presumption either way. I mean, just like with any criminal matter, the state has the burden of proving it beyond a reasonable doubt. So you just got the normal criminal standard.
But we can set it up restrictively enough in our regulations to require enough of a paper trail to put the burden on the industry to make the enforcement jobs easier, right? And the data collection. Because in the end, this is all about figuring keeping things above board so that we can get real data.
And I think it needs to go both ways. I think there needs to be teeth for the person that is wrongfully selling it and the person that is wrongfully buying it.
Well, will the penalty be?
I don't know, but I mean, it seems to me you need both ends of it, someone that's illegally selling them and someone that's illegally buying them.
And I think those would both be prohibited, and I can just answer one of the questions and then I'll let David sit here. There are a couple of things you're talking about that really are not part of the proposal. One is the fee. It involves the fee for the permit, and that's something that Bob was describing, that we can come back to the commission with. We can look at how much we think it's going to cost to administer this program and come back with a fee proposal. That's not part of this. This was just the regulations. And again, we can come back with a recommendation regarding an appropriate fee for these two permits and whether there should be another type of permit. On the reporting, that is also not. There is reporting that is required, but the specifics of those reports are really pretty much, those are basically delegated to staff. So the detailed reporting would be something that we have some flexibility in developing apart from this rulemaking process. And I know, as Matt just described, we'll be working on that.
I think points well taken. I think the input that we're getting, the interest that the commission is showing, helps staff right here just begin to formulate and think about, okay, well, where we end up a year from now or a few months from now with that program.
Are we
doing anything do we have any responsibility towards a health issue with other state agencies,
okay,
as far as allowing an unsafe product to get into the food chain, whether it's onshore or offshore?
The law is pretty clear that a state agency, just like so many governmental bodies, for one of the basics of our form of government is that the state agency only has that authority that is expressly granted to it, and that authority that is implicit in those express powers. We do not have authority to regulate generally. There are a few rare instances in the Parks and Wildlife Code, but in this particular arena, the Parks and Wildlife Department does not have authority to issue regulations based on human health. Our regulations are to be based on basically the survival of the species. There's some specific language in the Parks and Wildlife Code. The entity that's more charged with human health, I mean, there are all sorts of various entities. You have local health departments, you have the state health department. But again, our regulations are based on human health. Now, I should also point out that if there is a ban either in public water or in all water on collection, there will be an incidental effect in that it will, if there's a concern about the safety of turtles collected in these bodies, it will have an incidental effect of addressing those human health issues. But that's not, that can't be our just, that can't even legally be the justification for adopting these rules.
Yeah, our recommendation has got to be based on the resource. We are working with, through this process, just like we do in deer or several other species, with the appropriate health agency that has that kind of responsibility, be sure they know what we're doing. You know, if we can assist them in any manner, we will certainly do so.
Just so the commission knows too, beginning September 1, we are going to be contracting with Texas A&M University to begin looking at the commercial trade, and we'll be expanding upon that as the years go by. And this is the first step for us, and we're excited to take a closer look.
You mean to understand the trade itself?
The trade itself.
Both within the state, nationally, and I guess internationally.
Where are the pressures coming from? What is the demand? Yeah. How will it grow?
That's going to be the key.
And are these rules working?
I understand the marketplace.
So Matt, would you kind of summarize the regulatory alternative and recap where we are at this point, and also confirm we do not have any scientific indication evidence that there's a decline in these populations at this time in the state for these three species, right?
These three species at this time, I think, and it's safe to say there's experts that may know more detail, but there's not a concern to worry about them being a threatened species. There may be local situations where these turtles have been depleted.
Right.
We don't have that information.
This is one way to gather it.
That's correct.
Okay.
So our process here to proceed forward, Matt, your recommendations?
The recommendation is the current proposal. And to accommodate the private property concerns, we have this alternative, and we would like to for you to consider that as an alternative and adopt it.
Yeah. Wait, just for those three.
I want to ask one more question. In the lakes on private property, are we just going to allow the landowner to contract with a trapper, and they go in there and they just take all the turtles out of that lake they can possibly get out
of those three.
On private property.
Private property. Yes.
Yeah, those three.
With those three.
Yes.
Which they can do that non-commercially.
And knowing that, do we know whether or not turtles move back and forth between public waterways and private lakes and ponds?
We know that they do. When you build a pond, the turtles come from somewhere, and most likely they're from public water. Now, and some of these turtles can travel quite a distance. But there's experts here, and tomorrow you're going to hear a lot more. I would say that we our charge, if you should choose this alternative, would be to take a closer look at areas that are being heavily collected. And maybe this would be a study where you set up a study site, you heavily remove those turtles, and then look at the response from the public waters. How long does it take to replenish those areas?
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, when you remove the adult population from a pond, you have depleted the reproductive capacity for that pond. But that's not to say that other turtles wouldn't come into that pond over time.
Two questions. One, is a regulatory alternative in addition to the other or in lieu of the other one, the other proposal?
It would be in addition to the current
one. Under the regulatory alternative, if we would go with that, would the private landowner also have to have a permit to allow the commercial sale of those particular turtles?
Not unless the landowner was a dealer.
Okay, so then, how are we going to keep the record to ensure that those animals, in fact, have come from that landowner, as compared to from somewhere else?
That's totally open-ended.
But that's my understanding is that the staff is going to generate some specific recommendations to come back to.
Okay. But do you know whether you were anticipating having the private landowner also advise us that he, in fact, is selling commercially turtles on his plate or not?
Well, and this may be related to law enforcement, and we would probably need to know from a law enforcement standpoint where these turtles specifically are coming from.
That many?
And how many? And we could go back then and monitor those situations more closely.
Yeah, that's right. And where I was leading to is to the extent that a private landowner, for example, was depleting his turtle population because of the great demand, that we would reserve the right, perhaps on a site-specific, say, you know, in view of you're not having any. I'm just concerned about the private landowner that might have abuse, as you might say, of this particular exception. and how we could protect against that.
Yes. I think we're going to, we have to over the next year, take a closer look. It may be that some possession limit, some size limit would be appropriate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we could present that to you.
Here's the problem. I want to address one thing, if I may, Chairman. I've heard this a couple of times, and I'm afraid you said it. We're not talking about private property here. Okay? These tunnels are not private property. They are in private water. Now, I've seen some people make the statement that they're not in private water. They are in private water. Okay? So it's a very unique situation we have. It's still a wild animal. It's a public resource. And we don't allow commercial harvest of wild animals in most cases. You know, it's considered market hunting. Well, clearly that's the case on the public water, so we're going to eliminate that. Clearly the classic market hunting situation is not sustainable. We've got to stop. We're really in uncharted water here, and I think it's important that we go carefully, we understand what we're doing, and most importantly, we get as much data as we can and make sure that the people who are making money off this public resource are paying for us to get that data. Because if we drive it underground, you're not going to get the data. And I don't think you can wave your hand and ignore a couple of billion, you know, the demand of China. We're going to have to work our way through this whether we eventually move towards some sort of, is aquaculture the right term for a turtle? Vessel culture, whatever. No, that's a lobster. Lobster,
right?
Yeah,
right.
Aquaculture.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah. But we're in a no man's land here because this is a public resource, and allowing the commercial harvest of a public resource is usually in conflict with long-term sustainability.
Yes.
So we got a lot of work to do.
And I echo that. That's my concern with this because, you know, we're now making an exception, as you might say, for a public resource.
We're not only
making this, well, commercialized.
Well, we have some more important news than that. It's been reported from the Senate that Commissioner Bivens has been confirmed from the floor.
Hey!
Careful what you wish for,
Mark. I heard it was not a unanimous
vote. Is your prepared statement?
It was not a unanimous vote. Very good.
Chairman, Frank, I'm sorry for hogging there.
He raised good points. And down, Parker.
And coming off of what Commissioner Ramos said and the chairman, that we're in uncharted waters with this particular issue, what have other states done? And how have they treated this issue as opposed to what we are doing now in these uncharted waters? Can we learn anything by looking at other states, what they have done with the issue of the commercial turtle harvest?
And how would our regulatory alternative, if the dogs were compared to what some other states are?
This alternative would be the first that I know of in any state.
So every other state that you know of just allows commercial harvest of turtles?
Most other states have some form of regulation where there would be either a possession, a season, or a size limit. There are some states that are fairly unrestricted like Texas. There are other states that are completely prohibited commercial collection.
How many states have completely?
I would say about six, a half a dozen, that completely prohibited commercial collection. It may be.
Do you know what states those are?
I'm sorry, I can get that information for you.
Okay. And isn't that part of the reason there's such popularity in Texas compared to other states?
there's been some restriction in other states where they're getting people in Texas.
There are cases of people coming into Texas because of the latter restrictions, yes. We've heard from them.
Are there nonstop flights? Is DFW the only airport in the United States that flies nonstop to China? So why would people be using DFW as a gathering point for all of these other turtles coming across our state lines?
I'm not sure. It may have something to do with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents that may be assigned to those ports.
I think that's a question.
Yeah, I think the point is clear. We have to take into account the fact that if you don't have a complete ban, you are going to be a point of least resistance for bad operations, and you got to take that into your model. You know, I'm not at all convinced that this will work, but I think it'd be a mistake to not take the opportunity to gather the data, and as a transition towards aquaculture, because the demand is not going away. We just have to make sure that demand doesn't adversely affect our natural resources.
And in line with that, what Joe is saying, that there's nothing to keep us from granting a permit at will, as you might say, to where, as we see this develop and we see a particular landowner just hammering his turtle population, that permit could be terminated immediately.
Yeah, and that's the problem when you got a resource. You would think that the classic American wildlife management model would say, person's not going to do that to extirpate a renewable resource if you're doing it commercially. The problem in this case is that people may use the commercial avenue in order to extirpate as a pest control. That's not the way we normally set up incentives for management. But if you drive it underground, you'll never know what's going on. You'll never get to know that.
And the only other thing that I would refer all the commission to is this packet that is sitting in front of your desk that nobody has picked up. It looks like this, and it is letters from very knowledgeable people. You know, like the Fort Worth Zoo. Here's one that says brings in Mrs. Lee Bass's name to it. You have letters from all sorts of folks, both in the state and out of the state. And apparently, the state of Georgia has taken steps on this. Here's Baylor University. Florida's Freshwater Turtle Specialist Group, Go Cowboys, Oklahoma State. No offense with me, Bone Pickens was with me on that. Takata Reptiles and Wildlife Research Institute, Okinawa, and so forth and so on. Here is
John, I read through those, and I think it's overwhelming, the support for the position that I just stated, which is we've got to look at
capture information,
get the information we need to do that. Now, you know, I don't think anybody's going to disagree with the step of prohibiting all commercial trade in public waters. You know, the real question is, what do you do on the private side, and do take the opportunity to gather as much information as you can, as we're told. Now, when you get into this international wildlife trade issue, it's huge, and, you know, is there a legitimate way to do it? I'm not convinced there is, but I'm willing to give it a try as we gather the information.
There's a lot of demand for it, and you're right. It's a very serious issue, one that we need to gather
more. We're going
to
hear tomorrow. We don't decide on
anything. Right.
For me, is that we're opening up for the first time, like you said, Mr. Chairman, we're opening up the legitimization of commercialization.
No, we're not. We're restricting. It's open today. John, you've got it exactly opposite, I think. Today, it's complete wide open. We are putting some controls around it and completely prohibiting in the public waters, which are numerous, many tens of thousands of streams and miles of rivers.
And
right.
We will develop
what I'm trying to say. We don't want to let this overlap into another species.
No, I think you and I agree, market hunting is not sustainable. We've got a unique situation here that we have to look at very closely. And as I say, I'm not at all convinced that we don't have to go to a complete ban eventually. But I think it would be a mistake to not take the opportunity to gather as much information as you can, because if you drive this underground, you ain't going to get the data. You're not going to get the information. Now, we don't decide anything today. I think we need to take the opportunity tomorrow. We're going to hear from a lot of people tomorrow that are much better educated on the specifics than we are. But the policy issue, I don't think we should allow that to override the policy issue here of making sure that we keep things in the sunlight.
And I agree with you 100% on the driving this underground, because all those the exporters will do is just move to another airport.
Yeah.
Obviously, a complete ban would take away that commercialization. It would eliminate it. It may drive it underground as well. It's easier to enforce. I know from last commission meeting that, you know, we were asked to look at the sustainability. Is this activity sustainable or not? And so that is what we're providing here, is a movement towards that sustainability.
Could you find out between now and tomorrow what states do and don't otherwise?
Yes.
Yeah, and maybe where they permit or regulate turtle farming.
Yes.
With no wild, you know,
right.
Completely enclosed.
There are a number of those.
Okay.
Chairman?
Yeah.
I could respond to Commissioner Ramos had a question earlier and then a comment on the penalty. Some of it is an offense on this regulation. It's Class C misdemeanor, that's 25 to 500. From time to time, game wardens file falsification of a government document. We don't have that much success with convictions, but we do file that charge sometimes, and it's EB as high as a felony. And then he also commented about the person with the private pond, public resource in that pond. If they, even though they don't put their hands on the turtle, if they're receiving compensation for those turtles, well, then they're going to be required to have the non-game permit. Now, recently that was called a collector's permit, and it was a misnomer because we had people in the captive breeding business, and I think it would also apply to that person that owns that private property. If they're selling those turtles, they'll have to have a license as well. So there would be some recording of that at the end.
If each turtle is a separate offense, you're gonna have pretty high. You're gonna have.
And it would be.
Yeah. Each turtle is a separate offense. It's gonna be a pretty high price to pay.
Excellent.
Real prosecutor coming out of you.
Real prosecutor.
Do you have any other comments?
No, I don't.
Okay. Any discussion? All right. If there are no further questions or discussion, I'll place this item as amended with the regulatory alternative that we discussed on Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. And we are going to have a break for lunch and recess and
No, you need to do it now. You need to read the executive session first. Don't tell me I made a mistake in naming a new chairman here. Didn't they go over this with you in your confirmation here?
Page four. Thank you.
We will now recess for executive session pursuant to the requirements of Chapter 551 Government Code for a series of acts. An executive session will be held at this time for the purposes of deliberation of real estate matters under Section 551.072 of the Texas Open Meetings Act, and the purpose of seeking legal advice from the General Counsel under Section 551.071 of the Open Meetings Act.
Wait, you didn't read the part of it, but not from Rama. Take me for a
I'd like to, at this time, reconvene the regular session of the Conservation Committee. If there is no objection, I'll ask staff to begin the public notice and input process regarding the acquisition of a 62-foot by 92-foot tract of land at the J.E. Murphy Wildlife Management Area of Jefferson County in exchange of a driveway permit for a conservation easement on Parcel 4 connecting Longhorn Cavern and East Lake State Park in Burnett County, and a proposed 42-inch diameter pipeline across more than 14 miles of the J.E. Murphy Wildlife Management Area in Jefferson County. Okay. Is there any other business to be brought before the committee, Mr. Cook?
No, sir.
Very well. I will then turn the gavel over to regulations. Turn the
reconvene regulations. And go to committee item number 3, amendments to the public lands proclamation.
Mike Berger.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Mike Berger, Director of the Wildlife Division. And I want to be here today to discuss with you the proposed changes to the regulations governing public hunting lands for 2007-2008, including public comments received since the last meeting. Also discuss the candidate state parks proposed for public hunting access and the establishment of open season on public hunting lands. The first of these is a housekeeping item, the Public Lands Proclamation. The off-highway vehicle fee was established to fund the purchase, development, and maintenance of off-highway vehicle trails as part of a program administered by the department. The department's intent with respect to the funding of this program is to rely on true off-road vehicles enthusiasts to fund the recreational trails created for that purpose. The department has determined that the use of mobility-enhancing conveyances by disabled persons participating in activities on public lands is not consistent with the intent of the Parks and Wildlife Code and should not, therefore, be subject to the OHV fee. I would like to point out that we have three other similar housekeeping items that in total received 21 public comments. 14 were in favor, 6 were opposed, and 1 comment had no opinion. Those opposed were generally opposed to the use of public lands for hunting. The housekeeping item number 2, a special access permit would be authorized to a specific state park or part of a state park for persons who have been selected for public hunting privileges. This proposed amendment is necessary in order to comply with federal requirements that oblige the department to keep funds from the sale of permits for access to state parks separate from the funds from the sale of permits for access to wildlife management areas. This proposed amendment would acknowledge that distinction by rule. The next two items are related to this. The second is this amendment would conform the language of this section to reflect the applicability of the section provisions to the special access permit previously described. And this is where the fees and the regulations are established concerning the application process for permits on public hunting lands. The last related item there is in the state parks proclamation, and this does designate the fees for this special access permit, that they are $75 for up to a three-day hunt period, and an extended period, $125 for more than 3 days, but usually no more than 5 days. As we said before, this is necessary to comply with these federal requirements to keep the funds separate from parks and wildlife management areas. Also, today we need to adopt the 39 candidate state parks proposed for public hunting in the 2007-8 season. The list of state parks were provided in the hearing booklets as Exhibit C. There are 39 of the state parks proposed this year, and all were hunted in the last year. And only your approval tomorrow is necessary for this. And also to establish an open season. In order for us to conduct hunts on public hunting lands, the commission is required to establish an open season each year for these public hunting lands. This open season would run from September the 1st, 07 to August 31st of 2007.
Concludes my presentation. Do we have any questions or discussion? Okay. If there are no further questions or discussion, I'll place this item on a Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item number four, deer management permit rules and trap transport and transport and transplant rules.
Good afternoon, Chairman, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Mitch Lockwood, and I'm the statewide Whitetail Deer Program Leader. Today I'll present a proposal to modify our rules for our deer management permit, commonly referred to as DMP, and our transport and transplant permit, commonly referred to as a triple T. These proposed rule changes are intended to simplify our permitting processes and to recover the costs associated with administration and enforcement of these programs. First, I would discuss a recommended change to a rule pertaining to the DMP application. This rule currently states that changes to an approved deer management plan shall be considered as a new application. This rule makes a distinction between new and renewing DMP permits, because there's a difference in the fee between the two, with a new permit having a fee $400 greater than that of a renewal. Because there's an assumption that permit renewals require less overhead or that we're able to turn them around more quickly, but in reality, permit renewals for deer management permits have demanded more of our processing time because of this language right here. Because we have to spend more time on that application to make sure that no changes have been made to that previously approved DMP. And so recently we have designed a new, much more efficient, much more user-friendly process, a consistent process in how we go through and process these applications for all DMP applications, whether you're a first-time applicant or you've had a DMP for the last 5 years. And so therefore, we propose to simply strike this language from the reg. Next, we recommend a change to the composition of the respective review panels. As you may recall, the permit applicant may request a review of an agency decision to deny or delay permit issue. This is true of other deer permits as well. These various review panels that have been established over the years have been phased in, and there are some inconsistencies as a result in the composition of those panels. It is our belief that the review panels for triple T and DMP permits should include senior management and should be consistent with that of the scientific breeders review panel. Therefore, we recommend that we add the Deputy Executive Director for Operations and remove the Region Director and what for their program leader from these two review panels. Regarding the number of beers that can be detained within a DMP, current rule states that no more than one buck and 20 does may be detained from September 1st to January 31st. Now, including these dates in the rule is a little bit confusing because we've been operating this program to allow one to detain those same 21 deer all the way through the end of August. However, during those latter months of May, June, July, and August, they're likely to have fawns in that facility as well. So we propose to clarify this regulation by stating that at no time may a DMP facility contain more than one buck and 20 does, except for the fawns or the offspring or the products of those 21 deer. Currently, the DMP rules state that no trapping of deer under a DMP may take place between March 2nd and August 31st of any year. This rule is misleading because it implies that you can trap deer under a DMP on March the 1st, which is not the case. Since the intent of this program is for natural breeding purposes only, we do not permit the trapping of deer beyond the date when there is a high probability of trapping pregnant does. In order to maintain the intent and the integrity of this program, we rely on our statewide breeding chronology data. We use those data to establish some trapping cutoff dates for a DMP. Those data indicate that South Texas has the latest breeding season in the state, with December the 14th being the last day when there's not a high probability of trapping pregnant does. Therefore, we recommend that we clarify this regulation by stating that nowhere in Texas may one trap deer after December the 14th under a DMP. Now, this cutoff date will be a little bit earlier in other ecoregions, of course, those ecoregions that have earlier breeding seasons, and our DMP application packet will include the cutoff dates for the respective ecoregions. Current rules require that all adult deer within a DMP facility be ear tagged. We have determined that this practice is not necessary. It doesn't really provide much benefit to the department. And so we propose to simplify this rule by eliminating the ear tagging requirement. However, if this is adopted, this would not prohibit a permittee from marking the deer that are legally detained under a DMP. Next, we propose more flexible standards for the liberation of DMP deer. Current rules require that 100 contiguous yards of fence be removed or 100 contiguous yards of gate be opened for a period no less than 60 days to facilitate the release of DMP deer. But our rules allow us to make exceptions to this 100-yard and 60-day rule, which we commonly do. We've made so many exceptions over the years that we've determined that 20 foot of opening should suffice, provided that no opening is less than 10 foot wide. In other words, you can have multiple openings to meet this 20 foot requirement. We've also determined that a liberation period of no less than 30 days should suffice as well. Excuse me, And finally, on this topic, our regulations also require that one remove artificial feed and water for a period of 60 days. But we propose to clarify that regulation to state that 60-day period in which feed and water removed must actually be during the same time that the gates are open. In other words, during the liberation period. And again, we propose that be only 30 days as opposed to 60. And we also would like to clarify this regulation to state that the deer shall be released into the pasture from which they were captured. The final part of this proposal is an attempt to recover the costs associated with the administration and enforcement of these two programs. We're operating under the same philosophy that this commission proposed and endorsed a little over a year ago when we increased the scientific breeder's permit fee, and that was to recover all the costs associated with administering that program. Additionally, Parks and Wildlife Code states that the state may not incur any expense for the trapping, transporting, and transplanting of game animals and game birds under a triple T permit. Well, in FY06, the department incurred expenses nearing $121,000 for processing applications, performing site inspections, observing and enforcing compliance, and for prosecuting violations of Triple T Reg. So again, about $121,000 of expense for our revenue under Triple T for that same time period was about $13,500. So in an attempt to recover some of those costs, we propose to modify the Triple T fee. Our current fee is $180 whether the application includes a single release site or whether it includes 10, 20, however many release sites. $180 comes nowhere near covering the cost for processing and approving an application as a single release site, much less one with multiple release sites. We have determined that it costs us approximately $750 to process and approve an application with one release site. And therefore, we propose to increase the fee of a Triple T permit to $750 per release site, again, just in an attempt to recover costs. We believe that this is a conservative estimate since expenses such as fuel costs and whatnot do continue to increase annually, and we're basing these expenses on FY06 figures. And finally, we propose to modify the DMP permit fee as well. As I mentioned to you earlier, a new DMP permit application is $400 higher than that of a renewal. But again, if this proposal is adopted, we will have a much more efficient, more user-friendly process that allows us to process all DMP applications in a consistent manner. And therefore, we propose that all DMP permits are set the same fee of $1,000. This is the maximum amount allowed by statute, and this would, based on our figures, would just recover the cost in the enforcement administration of this program. And again, based on that on FY06 figures, which may be a conservative estimate. We received little public comment on this proposal. To date, we have 12 in support and 23 that oppose the DMP rule changes, and we have 13 in support and 18 that oppose the Triple T rule changes. Some of those in opposition are opposed to allowing for these practices at all, stating or implying that we're too liberal in what we allow private individuals to do as a public resource. So their comments really didn't pertain to this proposal. However, most of all the other opposing statements were almost identical to each other, and actually were almost identical to a position statement that we received yesterday from Texas Beer Association, which I believe you all have received as well. In essence, Texas Beer Association supports the proposed changes that provide more flexibility, but they are opposed to the proposed fee increase. And as I mentioned to y'all at the April Regulations Committee meeting, I presented these proposed changes to our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee and the Texas Wildlife Association Deer Management Committee last month. Our Whitetail Deer Advisory Committee is supportive of this proposal as it was presented today. And TWA's Deer Management Committee also voiced no opposition to the fee increases. Commissioners, that concludes my presentation. At this time, I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Questions or discussion? Okay, I will place this item on the Thursday Commission meeting agenda for public comment and action.
Thank you.
Item number 5, Delegation of Rulemaking Authority Concerning the State and Federal Rules in the Gulf of Mexico.
For the record, my name is Robin Rogers, Coast Fisheries Division. As indicated, I'm here to present an item, a proposed action item for delegation of rulemaking authority in the Gulf of Mexico to the Executive Director. As instructed by General Counsel, this basically creates the express written delegation of authority in our proclamation for rules which will allow us to create consistency when a federal rule change is made in federal waters and we wanted to implement that same rule change in state waters. We're given that authority under Section 7902 of our Parks and Wildlife Code. To date, we've had 9 people create comments on this, 7 have agreed and 2 disagreed. This morning, we also received a letter from the Texas Shrimp Association, which I believe will be distributed to you later today, that also opposes the rule. Their basic opposition is that they feel like it's not necessary that the current timing of those changes can be done within the normal framework of the commission procedure. That concludes my presentation, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Discussion? All right. Thank you. Place this item on the Thursday commission meeting agenda for public comment and action. Item 6, process for recommending seasons and bag limits for migratory birds. Mike and McGurk.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners. I'm Mike Berger, Director of Wildlife Division, here with Ron and Bevel. And we'd like to take this opportunity to talk to you about the process for establishing annual regulations for hunting migratory birds and the role of the federal government. We will hope to have you understand a very complex regulations process in a simple manner, and we won't try to go over all of it in great detail, but just demonstrate the complexity of it and how we play into that. Next slide. The driving force for migratory bird management in this country are our international and multinational treaties. Early in this century, some nations recognized that certain bird species crossed international boundaries and they were in trouble from market hunting and other reasons, and they needed that protection, and therefore the authority to regulate those birds because of their relationship with other countries is a federal responsibility. Countries with shared resources, migratory resources, entered into a number of treaties with the United States to protect those resources and discuss their management. The first of these was a treaty with Great Britain on behalf of Canada. We also have a treaty with Mexico, one with Japan, one with the former Soviet Union. And they all provide guidance and management authority, and some provide for habitat management as well. But because they're a shared resource with other states and countries, they have to be managed in accordance with federal law, and the states have input into this decision process. But the ultimate process is the responsibility of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. The result of these treaties, the Congress has to pass a law which institutes or enacts those treaties, and Congress passed the Migratory Bird Treaty Act in 1918, and since then it's been amended a number of times, but this offers much needed protection to many migratory bird species. It began, like I said, early this century when commercial trade in birds and their feathers was popular, and this act implements all the various treaties for the protection of these birds and stipulates protection for their habitats as well. And key components of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act make it unlawful to hunt, kill, or possess migratory birds except as permitted under regulations of the Secretary of Interior. And it authorizes the Secretary of Interior to determine when, if at all, to allow the hunting of these birds. That means the season is closed unless it's open. We do the same in Texas with our resident species. The seasons are closed unless they are opened by you. And the Migratory Bird Treaty Act does not prohibit states from making their own regulations, provided that those regulations are not more liberal than those approved by the Secretary. So what you need to know is that there are various types of regulations that go through this. The basic regulations are those that change rarely or infrequently. They include firearms restriction like clubbed guns and baiting, live decoys, non-toxic shot. Then we have annual regulations that's what we're going to talk a little bit about today. Items like season length, bag limit, frameworks for the season. And then special and other regulations are those that really don't fit either one of the other two. They may change more frequently than these basic regulations, and they may allow for special seasons like September teal and our special whiteland zones. And these are semi-permanent frameworks that provide an opportunity outside the standard season frameworks. But today we're going to focus on special regulations that apply to Texas, particularly to jump zones and splits for doves, as well as a quick overview of the annual cycle, and I will let Vernon lead you through that.
Thank you, Mike. For the record, I'm Vernon Bevel, a program director for Small Game and Habitat Assessment. As you all know, Texas is a large state, and we have seen fit to zone our state for both waterfowl and for doves. And in the case of doves, we have three regular zones, north, central, and south zone. And within the south zone, we have the special white wing area, which is a subcomponent of that south zone. And these zones allow us to set independent seasons for those zones within the frameworks and season dates and other criteria that Fish and Wildlife Service allow us to pursue as individual states. I might add that things like the special white wing season, which is unique to Texas, we have to still work those proposals up through our Central Flyway Council and have them approved and moved on to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Regulations Committee for their approval and subsequent presentation to the Director of Fish and Wildlife Service for formal approval. And within that, there are several federal register deadlines that have to be met along the way. For splits, which are segments of the season themselves, states that have zones are treated a little bit different than a state that does not have zones. If you only have two zones, you can have up to three hunt periods. In other words, you can hunt doves three different times. But because Texas is the only state that has three zones, they have limited us to two splits in our season, except for the fact that that subcomponent of the south zone, where the special white wing area has had its own little short independent season, those dates and those 4 days in the south zone are, however, taken away from the total number of days available to the south zone in general for dove hunting. So the regular dove season in the south zone is 4 days shorter because of the white wing area. And you will also remember, I believe, that we had quite a bit of discussion several years ago about the desirability of expanding the white wing zone, even as far out as I-37. We ended up being able to work a proposal through the Central Flyway Council, gain concurrence from the Central Flyway Council and the other three flyways to get to the service to recommend a smaller expansion of the white wing area from Highway 83, as shown in this map, up toward San Antonio to the northeast. So about a fourth of the area, a side of the whole area was increased. And this year we will be in our third year of a 5-year mandatory study to determine the impact on mourning dove harvest from that zone expansion. This zone line is a permanent line. We don't have the authority to change it. I might mention that zone lines in general can be tweaked every 5 years, but permanent zone lines like this one and the High Plain Mallard Management Unit line have to go back through a formal process independent of those 5-year intervals. Quickly, I will go over the annual cycle with you, which functionally started with our preliminary discussions back in November with the Commission of possibilities for migratory bird changes that were then moved forward to our Flyway Technical Committee at their winter meeting in December, and then back to our Flyway Council. There's some conference calling in January. We brought back to you at your January meeting some discussion of some of those changes, and then on forwarded them on to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service at their first Service Regulations Committee meeting in February. And I'm one of the two consultants for this flyway. Each flyway has two consultants. So it's a very process-driven, deadline-oriented system by which we make these regulations. By the time we get to this period of the year, May, we're doing waterfowl surveys to determine the breeding population level, dove surveys for similar purposes. Those numbers will be crunched along with the data from the last year's season to look at what the harvest rates were. In late May, we're here again talking with you about those regulatory items, and you have your functionally your last chance to comment on them before we move forward. In June, I attend the Service Regs Committee meeting in Washington along with other consultants to discuss this proposal with them, and hopefully we gain support of the service and recommendations from the Service Regs Committee to their director. July is the real crunch time, because we're formalizing our season proposal for Mr. Cook to sign off on at the same time that the Outdoor Annual is publishing those same proposals, and technically the Federal Register that proposes them as an alternative is just being published. And the final Federal Register for early season species will not be published this year until August the 31st, and dove season starts the next day. So you can't drop the ball anywhere along the way without a bad thing happening. And then sort of kind of sum it up, we go through about 9 or 10 months of a very procedural-oriented process, of which we've just given you the thumbnail sketch of, that requires that we follow the rules, and that for Texas to succeed, Texas has to work within the Central Flyway to gain support of the other flyway states. For any proposal we have, vice versa, every state's the same way. And then we have to sell our proposal on its biological merit to the Fish and Wildlife Service for their concurrence. We'd be glad to answer any questions if you have them.
I wanted to appreciate your attention to this, because, you know, Mr. Bevel and the wildlife guys through the years try to be very responsive to the commission and to the constituents that are people who hunt. And people have a lot of ideas about migratory seasons and bag limits and morning hunting and, you know, all that stuff. And I wanted to appreciate Bevel and Mr. Berger going over this, because it's not that we can't change. We can't. We can work within this system. We just got to anticipate it far enough ahead and be prepared, because a lot of times just the immediate bounce back from the feds is, well, we'll go get some data to prove the point or prove that we're wrong. Well, back to the gray trucks we go, and out in the bushes with binoculars or whatever. And 5 years later, maybe we have an answer for you, and maybe we do not. So,
and it always involves trade-offs.
And through the years, the agency has had really good people who worked this process, real respected in the flyway across the nation for the way we handle things. Our goal is to provide as much hunting opportunity as we believe the resource can stand. I mean, that's bottom line. And the combinations of that kind of duck or that kind of dove, you know, sometimes gets us in a pretty complex situation. That's where we are.
And what we just wanted you to understand was it is a very complex process. And we just went through one early season. The late season may be a little more complex than that, because it involves more species. But just so you understand how complex it is and what challenges we have with it. Yes, sir.
Well, I just say, over the years I've been on the commission, I've had a sense of how complex it is. I've never seen the full program. I think y'all do a very nice job of presenting alternatives at the appropriate juncture. So you give a lot of flexibility and listen to constituents. And there's a good one backed up by some sort of constituent input, so I compliment you on that, because this is clearly a high wire act. You got to run it every year and get this on schedule and do it right. So.
And when we start getting background noise from constituencies on interest in some other change or some other wrinkle, we've always discussed those with our Game Bird Advisory Board.
Right.
Usually, if it was a significant enough interest that we've determined, we then go out and do some type of mail survey to gain a kind of better, broader brush review from our hunting constituency of the levels of interest in this option versus that option. So when we come back to you all to talk about regulatory change, we've not just looked at one locale in a particular zone. We've looked at that zone-wide hunter base and tested the parameters of change with them to see if they fit pretty well. And when it required us going to Fish and Wildlife Service for their support up through our Flyway Council, one good example was our tuna season. Some years ago, we had interest in the Eagle Lake area and expanding the teal season. And we started looking at the numbers and decided that, yeah, the teal population had an expansion. So then we started working that through our flyway, and a couple of five or six states in the flyway wanted some similar option. Flyway, Mississippi Flyway wanted some similar option. Atlantic Flyway wanted some similar option. So by the time that we got all this vested interest in a longer teal season, it eventually took us 4 years of working with the flyways and Fish and Wildlife Service to implement the 16-day teal season. That's just how it works.
One of the classic examples, and I'll drag this out even more, but one of the classic examples on dove hunting, we almost every year, correct me if I'm wrong, get someone who suggests we should only dove hunt in the afternoon. And the thought process usually is that would give us that many more afternoons. We can take those not so.
Right.
We don't get twice a year in the afternoon. The commission previously, and this is where we would look to you for the guidance as we go through the years and these kind of things. The commission's option has been to say, look, we can allow all day hunting, and we opt to do that. If a landowner chooses to hunt only in mornings, fine. He can make that decision. Or only in afternoons, fine. He can make that decision. Now, that's been the philosophy that we've operated on most of these. Give as much option, let the landowner decide. That doesn't always make everybody happy either, but that's where we've been. So if there's other guidance, why, we would welcome it at any time.
Mr. Chairman, if it's possible to provide the commissioner a copy of this PowerPoint presentation,
I would even recommend that we go back to maybe the first draft of this presentation, which has a little more detail in it. I think you'll find it interesting.
Right.
We
would
leave it out of the
issue. I am. Well,
A couple of pounds.
You can explain it
about
that
to your brother.
Yeah.
Great.
Appreciate
it.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
Sure,
absolutely.
Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Cook, is there any other business you'd like right before these commissions? If not, we'll return.
Thank you.
See you tonight.
Thank you.
5 o'clock.